So those two new levels, we're at number 16 on page 3, the two added levels, the symbolic and then the total commitment in love, are particularly relevant to religious studies. So again, a philosophy of religion is going to have to be aware of all of this, okay? The symbolic operator that shapes the development of sensibility and in its ultimate achievement guides the Jungian process of individuation would seem highly relevant to an investigation of religious symbols, And the soul of religion, so that's the lower level, if you want, using the spatial metaphor. And the soul of religion, the highest level, has been seen to lie in a total commitment that embraces the universe and frequently does so in adoration of a personal God. From a Christian viewpoint, this total commitment is being in love in an unrestricted manner. It is associated with Paul's statement that God's love has flooded our inmost heart through the Holy Spirit he has given us. It is complemented by God's manifestation of love for us in the death and resurrection of Jesus. But we must also attend to other religions. Scripture itself bids us do so. By their fruits you will know them. God wills to save all, and so it must be presumed that God gives the charity described in 1 Corinthians 13 to more than Christians. But we may also move, so he's got scriptural grounds for this, but then also other grounds. We may also move to a universalist view of religion by following Raimundo Panikkar's move to lived religion or mystical faith prior to and beyond formulation, or Whitson's discernment of a convergence of religions. So again, themes that he's mentioned earlier. Or by bringing these two standpoints together in a single integrated view. Lonergan ends this section by stating that, and I quote, what in a philosophic context I have named being in love in an unrestricted manner, in a theological context could be paralleled with Karl Rahner's supernatural existential. Now, just a comment on that last statement there. I don't consider myself a Rahner scholar, so I may be wrong on this, but I think that sometimes Rahner uses supernatural existential to mean the tidal movement in us heading towards the supernatural. And then other times he uses it to mean God's grace, which is always present as an existential. So I think his meaning of the term is twofold. Sometimes he uses it to talk about what for Lonergan would be nature heading upwards to God. And at other times he uses it to talk about grace, which is really supernatural. So I would want to reserve the term supernatural existential to the second meaning of grace. But I think that there's a study that is needed on the relationship of the natural and the supernatural in a number of thinkers and how they're related to each other. De Lubach, who was the one who raised the question in a very significant way in the 20th century, Rahner and Lonergan, at least those three, I'd like to see a study of comparing the three of them to one another.
Well,
yes.
I'm of the understanding that when Rahner uses a supernatural existential, he is he's appropriating Heidegger.
And oh, yeah, definitely. The term existential, yeah. That's definitely true. But what is it that is supernatural? See, that's the issue. Not the existential. The existential he's definitely taking from Heidegger. That he's saying that in addition to all the existentials that Heidegger mentions, there's a supernatural existential. And there's grace, and that is an existential, and it's very much an existential in the sense that Heidegger uses that term. But Rahner doesn't always talk about it as grace. I think sometimes he talks about it as the obediential potency for grace, which is nature. But the existential is definitely appropriated from Heidegger, the term existential. The fourth section provides two items, then, in a heuristic structure for religious studies. So two contributions that a philosophy of religion can make to religious studies. Now, this is taking us back to some of the things that he said in those three essays on religious studies and theology. The first element arises from the distinction between authentic and unauthentic. So a philosophy of religion can illuminate religious studies with this distinction. The distinction is relevant both to the object of religious studies and to the subject. There's authentic religion and there's unauthentic religion. There's religion that does peace and there's religion that does violence. We're just one way of sorting those things through. There's also an authentic religious subject and an unauthentic religious subject. I think we're seeing in our own day that nothing is more harmful to the world than unauthentic religion, whether it be Islam or Christianity or any other religion. It is relevant to the object, for the followers of a given religion may represent it authentically or unauthentically to provide contradictory evidence on the nature of the religion under investigation. A lot of people think that when they hear the word Christian, they think that you're talking about biblical fundamentalists, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. And I heard one person say that, for a long time he thought the Romans were right, that all Christians should be thrown to the lions. But it was because, for him, Christians were these raving lunatics. And the same is obviously true with Islam. And the Islamic community is suffering deeply today because there are so many nuts and there are, who are claiming to be representatives of Islam, and then there are others who are very gentle and peaceful people. So that's one. But it's also relevant to the subjects who are carrying out religious studies, for they may be humanly or religiously authentic or unauthentic, and so offer contradictory interpretations of the same data. There's the interesting book by Sam Harris, which I haven't read, but I think I've mentioned it in here before, The End of Religion or The End of Faith or something like that. But what Harris is saying is, I had a long conversation with a Jew one afternoon who wanted to talk to a non-Jew about this book, and somebody gave him my name, so he came to talk to me. But Harris is basically claiming that religion is really fundamentalism, and it's fundamentalist Christianity, it's fundamentalist Islam, whatever. And let's just face it, and all those people, whether they be Christians or Muslims, who are nice or gentle or moderate, well, they're not really representing their religion very well, because their religion is crazy. This is basically the thesis in his book. So the moderates are as bad as the others because they're trying to water down what the religion is really all about. And he says what we should do is just throw everything out. So this Jew was quite taken with this and wanted to know what I thought about it. But at any rate, see, the subjects carrying out religious studies will offer contradictory interpretations of the same data, okay? So, and then he goes on for a good page arguing how important these questions are in religious studies. The second element that that a philosophy of religion can bring to religious studies, it has to do with differentiations of consciousness, or again, the various contexts in which religious living occurs and investigations of religious living are undertaken. What fascinates me with this was the whole thing that's in number 18 here, is how he has, in a very short compass, put so many different things together. He speaks about 8 different social arrangements: family, customs, mores, community, education, state and law, economics and technology. So that's various things affecting social arrangements. And then 5 areas of cultural interest: art, religion, science, philosophy, history. Now, there are 4 stages distinguishing the scope of these social and cultural arrangements. Okay? So 4 different stages. And all of these things change from one stage to another. All of these social arrangements, all of these areas of cultural interest change. The 4 stages are like the 3 stages of meaning in method and theology, and the 3 plateaus that he spoke about in Natural Right and Historical Mindedness. But here he's divided the first one into 2: the linguistic, the literate. So there's a difference between speaking and both speaking and writing. Okay, so there are people who can speak but can't write. That's linguistic. And then speaking and writing, the literate, that's a differentiation there. And then there's, beyond that, the logical and the systematic, the theoretical, and then the methodical. So what in method and theology had three stages of meaning. You had the common sense, theory, and interiority. Here, common sense is linguistic and literate, the first two, reading and writing, speaking and reading and writing. The logical, what here is the logical, is what in method he meant, he called theory. And the methodical is what in method he called interiority. So, as we move from one to the other, these social arrangements will change, and the cultural interests will develop. So that art, music, literature, philosophy, theology, are going to be different depending on whether or not a culture has moved beyond common sense to theory or beyond both of those to interiority. There's going to be a change in the social arrangements and in the cultural initiatives. The stages, the four stages, are not universalized so that we don't all go from one to the other. But they're people living together. People living together in the same city, obviously. Look at Toronto, for heaven's sake. People who can and cannot read and write, linguistic and literate, okay? People who can and cannot operate on propositions and construct systems of thought. People who can and cannot take the move to interiority, where systems lose their absolute status. And so on. So there will be stratification in society in terms of these stages of meaning, and there will be alienation. Stratification. People who are more advanced, who have gone through more stages, who can read and write, and can follow an argument, and are familiar with interiority and so on, well, they might be able to initiate a lot more new ideas and a lot better social arrangements than if they're still at the level of linguistic, but nothing more. Okay. On the other hand, they can get carried away with it too. And then alienation, because people who are not, who haven't moved along, they might feel themselves living in a social situation which is beyond their comprehension, motivated by appeals to values that they really don't appreciate. And those who have will be alienated when they hear simplistic moral thought, social thought, crude cultural creations, religious fundamentalism in Christianity, for instance. I mean, you just get exasperated with it. What is the thing that I saw recently? That there may be some people in the present administration in Washington who really believe that the world is about to end and Jesus is going to come and gather us all up into a cloud. Well, for heaven's sake, give me a break. These people are determining what's happening in the world. Well, that's like, these are people who are at best linguistic illiterate, in the sense that they can read and write, but they haven't worked their way through anything if they still are holding on to that kind of a worldview. They haven't worked their way through any systems of thought, any logical systems, any science, any hermeneutics, to say nothing of interiority and the methodical point of view. So religion, number 19, is going to find itself in different, varying, in different social and cultural contexts. It's going to work out its identity in different social and cultural contexts. And as those contexts change, the religion is going to change in some aspects of its identity. And This is one of the challenges that is in front of us today. In the linguistic stage, religion will manifest itself mainly as myth and ritual, the kind of thing that Girard has studied, and the kind of thing that so easily becomes scapegoating violence, and so on. In the literate stage, it will become the religion of the book, the Torah, the Gospel, the Koran. Now, notice, we're not giving up the earlier stage as we move to the next. Because we've moved to Torah, Gospel, Koran, doesn't mean we've given up liturgy. Okay, but it's different. It's very different from finding a scapegoat and burning them at the stake. In the logical stage, it will issue dogmatic pronouncements and seek overall reconciliation in systematic theologies. In the methodical stage, it will confront its own history, it will distinguish the stages in its own development, it will evaluate the authenticity or unauthenticity of its initiatives, it will preach its message in the many forms and styles appropriate to the many social and cultural strata of the communities in which it operates. And that's the challenge today, is for us to be able to do that, to be able to preach the message in one way when we're in one community and another way when we're in a different community. And then he goes into how the stages have been related in Christian history, which I think we can probably skip. Can we pause? There's probably a lot of stuff that you want to reflect on or ask about.
Go ahead.
Well, in religion and violence, the class, there is an experience of reading the text to the hijackers of the 9/11, the hijackers.
Yes.
And it looks.
A text to them? Reading a text to them?
Yeah, there was a text that they found in a luggage of one of the ones who was supposed to be a hijacker.
Oh, I see. Like, okay.
And it was in other two places. And the language is totally religious. And I remember that once you said that from the up-downward vector, anything can come. And that's the experience that I had. The religion, really, the religious language can come from up. And in the downward vector, it can make the person do anything. A person can give a life in the name of religion, in the name of Allah. These people, it looked according to the instructions that they just went through the same rituals that I do in the Christian religion, prayer, meditation, rituals, and they went into a very violent situation.
Mm-hmm.
And is this, according to this, it looks like the religion progresses, but what I thought was that Lonergan wanted to confront this downward vector with the upward, you know, somehow make them complement each other and confront your religion, your religious experience, also with your humanity, with your sense of development, human development. Is that true, or is this your conclusion?
No, that is true. And see, what he's talking about, these stages are stages of human development from below upwards.
Okay.
From the linguistic to the literate to the logical and systematic to the methodical. Okay, those are stages of human development. And religion must accommodate itself to those stages, is what he's saying, without sacrificing what's genuine in it, if there is anything genuine in it. Okay. Now, the only religion where I'm capable of taking a stand on that is that, you know, is there is such a thing as authentic Christianity. It's represented in the Sermon on the Mount. It's represented in Paul's, the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and the experience of God's love, all right? But that is going to, that's a constant, and yet it will manifest itself under different and adapt to changing social and cultural situations. And what operates the change in the cultural and social situations is the development of meaning. It's development in the area of meaning. So it could be techniques of meaning, it could be carriers of meaning, it could be different elements of meaning, but from the linguistic to the literate, I mean, you're moving to a new carrier of meaning. The written word is a different carrier of meaning from the spoken word. And then from there to some logical or systematic capacity for systematic reflection and to interiority. I'm getting a little tired, so I'm not. I don't know if I'm making sense. Am I making sense? But the stages are the unfolding of human development from below upwards. Now, some of these, interestingly enough, are prompted by God's grace, I think, or by reflection on God's grace. The West never came to a definition of person until they tried to figure out the Trinity, you know. And we came to a deeper understanding of what the human person was when we tried to say, what are the three of in God? You know, what word are we going to give to that? And then they started coming up with definitions of person, you know. Boethius and Richard and St. Victor and Aquinas, three definitions of person. But we didn't have a definition of person prior possibly to Augustine saying, well, let's use the word persona for what there are three of in God. And then they said, well, what is that? What are the three of in God? So in other words, our self-understanding can be prompted by questions having to do with understanding the movement from above downwards. There you go.
Well, my questions are all over the place, but...
He raises a lot of questions.
Well, even the whole idea of the stratification and alienation in cultures and society, it would seem that there's a lot of responsibility then in cultures for education. It seems like education is directly related to differentiation of consciousness.
Education, see, for Lonergan, is the key to the whole thing. And somebody also, when they asked him about the economics, you know, his economics, how are you going to get this across to people? Education, you know? That's all, you know? And you got to have good teachers who can break it down, present it in a way that people are capable of understanding. And the same with the rest of it, you know? But, gosh, when I see some of the stuff that people are doing under the name of religion, and Christians now. I'm not talking about Muslims, I'm talking about Christians. It has nothing to do with the gospel. You know, nothing. And yet, this is what people are identifying with Christianity. You know.
I think in this article, he clearly differentiated the functions of philosophy of religion.
Yes.
But, for instance, in TST here, it's not so clear what should be the role of a philosopher of religion.
No.
I'm saying this because there is even, the name is not so clear. Some call it philosophical theology.
No.
Some call it philosophy of religion.
No.
Then someone like myself, I'm a little bit confused. The difference even between systematic theology and...
Systematic theology for Lonergan would be quite different from what he's talking about as philosophy of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Systematic theology is the attempt to understand in an integrated way the constitutive meaning of the Christian church.
Okay.
So it would be understanding the doctrines with regard... Well, he would say you start with the Trinity and the incarnate word and grace and the last things, the promise of eternal life. Those four basic things. And then you work out at your understanding of everything else in relationship to your understanding of those four things. Those are the four distinct Christian beliefs,
whatever.
Trinity, the incarnate word, grace is present everywhere. The doctrine of grace is really quite Judeo-Christian.
Yeah.
And then the promise of eternal life.
Yeah.
But philosophy of religion here is more like what is the appropriate stance to have? What do you have to have? What equipment do you need in order to do religious studies? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things in TST would be there would be a division between those people who would say, don't bring in any of this value stuff, mm-hmm. or anything to do with, that's just scientific rigor.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, for Lonergan, that's truncated, because that's just experiencing, understanding, and judging. And the point that he's making in this paper is that the fourth level is intrinsic to religion. And so if you're going to understand religious phenomena, you must know what's going on with fourth-level activity, and you must acknowledge that it's different from experiencing, understanding, and judging. Beyond that, there's symbol and love, and you've got to have that to be able to do religious studies. If you don't have an appreciation of symbols, mm-hmm. and you don't have an appreciation of total commitment, mm-hmm. then you don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. When you read a religious document, you don't know what the New Testament is talking about, what Paul's talking about when he talks about charity. You don't know what he's talking about. You can't if you don't have an appreciation for total commitment. That doesn't mean you have to be perfect and totally committed yourself, but you have to acknowledge there is such a thing, and it's a good thing, and you have to appreciate it. Otherwise, you can't appreciate religion.
Yeah, I'm saying this because... You come in contact with some professors. It's not just difficult for you to realize that what philosophy of religion and theology, different understandings, approaches.
There are different understandings and approaches. Yeah. So this is his. This is his. This is what he would say. I would accept it. Mm. I get along with these professors that you're talking to.
Yeah.
I don't agree with them on these things.
No, I just... <that's fine.
laughs> He knows.
Anything else that we need to do? Shall we move on to horizons and transpositions? Can you handle another big paper?
Do you want to open the door?
Because it's quiet. We're not going to get through horizons and transpositions, but we can get started. All right. This was the only paper that Lonergan wrote just to give at a Lonergan workshop at Boston College. It's the only place where he gave it. A lot of times he would give papers there, but they would always be papers that he gave somewhere else, and then he'd come and give them at the Lonergan workshop. But this one he wrote for the workshop, and he actually was finishing it while the workshop was going on, because he's making reference to some of the papers, including my own, that were distributed at the workshop. It was very interesting. And I can remember I was there, and he came in, and it's a long paper, and the first thing that he said, and this must be before the recording, because this doesn't show up on the recording, is, brace yourself, I've got 27 pages. that isn't on the recording, now that I think of it, but it's a long thing. Anyway, what is on the recording, and not in the paper itself, but we put it into the footnote, is that it was prompted by a remark made by Father McCool from... Fordham, who's been a rather remarkable student of 20th century Thomism, to the effect, McCool said that, McCool likes Lonergan, but he was saying there's no logical connection between Lonergan's position and that of St. Thomas. In other words, Lonergan's standing on his own, and there's no logical connection between the two of them. And then Fred Lawrence responded to McCool, well, Lonergan's not talking about drawing logical conclusions, but he is transposing a lot of things that are already in Aquinas. So Lonergan said, I took the idea of this from Lawrence's response to McCool to talk about, what do you mean by transposition, transposing? Transposition is something that becomes necessary once one admits such a thing as a change of horizon. So those four stages, for instance, would all be changes of horizon. For changes of horizon take us out of the field of deductive logic and its conclusions. If you're within one horizon, logic will work. But if you've leapt, taken a jump from one horizon to another, there won't be logical conclusions. You can't, because you're in another world. So such a change may be a jump, and just a jump, but it may also be a genuine transposition, a restatement of an earlier position in a new and broader context, which, with respect to a lot of Aquinas, is what Lonergan thought he was doing. He was restating a lot of Aquinas in a new and broader context. And he gives an example from science that Einstein's special relativity was a transposition of Newton's laws of motion. It wasn't a denial of them, but it wasn't a logical conclusion from them either. But it transposed them into a new and much broader context. So his first point is the link between the notion of horizon and the notion of transposition. A change of horizon cannot be demonstrated from a previous horizon. And so the genuineness of transpositions cannot be a simple logical conclusion. But what is basic is authenticity. And it may be that Lonergan's faithful to Aquinas, even though you can't logically deduce what Lonergan says from what Aquinas says. He's taken the spirit of it and transposed it into a contemporary context. So the lecture will illustrate the notion of genuine transposition. The first question is the transposition from a Palestinian to a Hellenistic horizon in Christianity. The first question it faces is the question that Harnack raised. Did the high Christology of the Church emerge under the dominance of a Hellenistic milieu? So the Christology that acknowledges the divinity of Jesus. Okay. Martin Hengel, his book, The Son of God, argues here in the negative that it's not. Hengel argues that there is a high Christology expressed in Palestinian language in the letter to the Galatians, in the two letters to the Corinthians, and in the letter to the Romans. And he says that, now that's very early in Christianity. And it's almost impossible that this happened under Hellenistic influence. And he said if it did, then more happened in the first two decades of Christian history than in the subsequent seven centuries. So it was rather that within the Palestinian context, and not by the invasion of Greek categories, the community came to see that there's something quite extraordinary about this Jesus that raises the question of who he was and forces a conclusion that is more than Christology purely from below would be able to accommodate. Moreover, Lonergan says, Eric Vogelin has shown that the real meaning of Hellenistic philosophy is quite different from the caricature painted by Harnack and the History of Religion school, where all such speculation is reduced to ideology. Vogelin argues it's personal morality and social order that motivate the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle. Their philosophy is therapeutic. Hadot has said the same thing more recently than Vogelin. Philosophy was basically therapy, intellectual therapy. Therapeutic in a sense similar to the intellectual therapy of insight. And then Lonergan says, well, as long as we're talking about the intellectual therapy of insight, let me share with you what's happened in my own intellectual therapy since insight. So he goes on a long way to telling us where he's come since then. And he does, in doing that, he uses a lot of the same kind of language that he used in Natural Right and Historical Mindedness. But here I find this very interesting. To think of human nature, we distinguish a series of horizontal processes, experience, understanding, judgment, decision, traversed by a vertical process. Each horizontal process has its own principle, yielding movements, first of movement and then of rest, on the successive levels of sensitivity, intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility, experience, understanding, judgment, decision. The vertical process that cuts through them springs from now a new language. Earlier it was the passionateness of being, it was a tidal movement, now it's an undifferentiated eros, commonly referred to as the unconscious. springs from an undifferentiated eros, commonly referred to as the unconscious, influences in turn each of the horizontal movements, and finds its proper goal beyond them in a self-transcending being in love. That begins in the home, reaches out to the tribe, the city-state, the nation, humankind, and finds its anchor and strength in the agape of the New Testament. It's interesting, this is my comment, to see how he here fills out the earlier passionateness of being or tidal movement with his speaking of an undifferentiated eros. Running through all of the successive horizontal processes of discrete principles of movement and of rest is the vertical drive from undifferentiated eros to agape. It transmutes our sensitivity from a biological function into the carrier of artistic inspiration, into an instrument of practical and theoretical intelligence, into an embodiment of wisdom's concern for the true and the good. Now here, Mary Jo, you'll see sensitivity and feeling and so on permeate all the way through. What all of this has to do with the question of Christology and the emergence of Christianity is shown in the subsection on Vogelin's paper, The Gospel of Culture, which Lonergan here summarizes. I was thinking as I wrote these notes the other day, if I had a choice, I would give Vogelin's paper, The Gospel and Culture, to every incoming student at Regis College. And I would say, let's spend a month discussing this paper and its implications. It's remarkably provocative paper. Lonergan's own development presents, quotes, a contemporary context for Vogelin's account in his earlier paper, Reason, the Classic Experience. I think I've made that point here earlier, that paper, if you didn't know who wrote it, you might think it might have been Lonergan, Reason, the Classic Experience. But his, that was not the earlier paper. He had an earlier and longer paper, The Gospel of Culture. The Gospel and Culture argues that Christianity could become dominant. Why did it become dominant? In the decaying Roman Empire and the subsequent history of Europe, it became dominant because it was in tune with a question to which it gave an answer. And the reason it's not dominant today is that the very question has been lost. The question is expressed by Vogelin as the search for direction in the movement of life. There is a direction in existence, and as we follow it or not, life can be death, and death might be life eternal. This double meaning of life and death is the symbolism engendered by our experience of being pulled in various directions and our need to choose between them. There is a tension of existence between the human and divine poles, experienced as a seeking from the human side and a drawing from the divine side. This experience is basic, original. That's Vogelin's term for it, the original experience of the search for direction in the movement of life. I use this over and over again in Theology and the Dialectics of History. Basic, original, prior to the emergence of any philosophy. And it's only from the travail of this movement that the questioner emerges, and that God emerges as the mover who attracts or moves us to himself. Vogelin finds these pulls and counterpulls in Greek philosophy, and they also constitute the tension of Christian existence, so that there is need for a discernment of spirits if one is to follow the call of God's grace, and even of different rules to be applied under different circumstances. That is Lonergan's Ignatian addition to what Vogelin says. Thus, Justin Martyr saw Christianity as philosophy in its state of perfection, which is true as long as philosophy is the love of wisdom. Still, why does this philosophy have to become metaphysical? And why does Christianity include metaphysics implicitly in its early councils and in the later theologians, and in the better theologians? This question basically is postponed until the third section of the chapter, although even at this point, Lonergan points, remember the thing I said about Ikhnaton the other day, this is what he's referring to, the hymn to Amon as the sole god. This was Ikhnaton's hymn, the Greek, Egyptian pharaoh. Vogelin interprets this as a remarkable illumination with respect to being and a remarkable differentiation of consciousness in a culture that wasn't ready for it. But another scholar, John Wilson, says, no, it really isn't. That's giving it too much credence. So Lonergan is just simply drawing attention to there's a conflict over that interpretation. But what Lonergan claims to have done in the first section is to have shown that there is a connection between the Gospels and certain aspects of Greek culture, so that transposition of the Gospel meaning across horizon shifts is possible. The Gospel could be transposed into this culture because the question about the meaning of existence was already, the search for direction in existence was already alive in the culture. Vogelin says that in many ways that question itself is being lost in the contemporary world. It's being drowned out by so many different things. Noise, drugs, so on and so forth. A second example of transposition is what happened in the medieval rise and fall of scholasticism. Lonergan's argument is that the medieval rise of scholasticism was due to the emergence of a theological method, and that the medieval fall of scholasticism in the 14th century was due to the decline of method and the dominance of deductive logic. So again, from Aquinas, which was the high point, to Scotus, who started the downward movement. We've seen this argument before, so we may skip to the final subsection on horizon and wisdom. The rise and fall of medieval scholasticism was a succession of horizons. The rise culminated in the wisdom of Aquinas. The fall lost that wisdom through an initial contentiousness, followed by an overmastering concern for science, strictly so called, a notion of science set forth in Aristotle's Posterior Analytics, which was purely logical deductivism. And then the third issue, maybe we can finish this. We've got 5 minutes. Let's see if we can do it. Treats some elements in a transposition to the post-Vatican II horizon. Lonergan applauds, as we'll see again in the paper that Mary Jo's going to comment on in a couple of weeks, the pastoral intent of Vatican II, particularly as this was interpreted by Chenu. But he also suggests that an outstanding characteristic of the post-Vatican II horizon is a certain disregard of doctrinal issues. And this, I know that this bothered him. And he was convinced that the pastoral office and pastoral, the pastoral office, not meaning just popes and bishops, but the pastoral function of the church will suffer if we simply jettison our doctrinal past. So what then is the post-Vatican II horizon with which we must be concerned? First thing is, well, there is such a thing as secularism, and that would be the denial of the fourth and fifth levels, or the denial of the concern for of affects being drawn to by God to God and so on and so forth. He traces the roots of secularism to Descartes' separation of philosophy and theology, to Kant's attempt at seeking religion within the limits of reason alone. But he also, very interestingly, finds secularism in ecclesiastical politics. He finds secularism in the initial draft of the First Vatican Council that attributed too much to the human intellect, saying that we can, even in our fallen state, arrive with certainty at the knowledge that God exists. Well, that draft was changed by the fathers of the council, and they left out the whole thing about in our fallen state. Okay, there is a natural knowledge of God, but we only get to it through grace. And that's the position that Lonergan, that's what Lonergan interprets as the position that Vatican I taught. The second and related issue today is, well, where does philosophy begin? For Vogelin, it begins from the pulls and counterpulls of existential experience. From that base, we can develop a love of wisdom that is philosophy. But that base is not explicit, but tacit knowledge. It becomes explicit only in such things as rules for discernment, or something like intentionality analysis. Then it becomes explicit. But Lonergan says, now that it's out in the open, let's talk about it. It supports the view of beginning from a phenomenology of coming to know as a series of acts, start philosophy there. Use that as a basis for an epistemology that explains why such acts constitute knowledge. And thirdly, conclude with a metaphysics of proportionate being that is critical in the sense that its terms and relations are isomorphic with the terms and relations of cognitional theory. So that's, for him, philosophy. We've seen that already. A third issue in the contemporary context is the new notion of science. Modern science is not concerned with the necessary, but with the possible. Modern science proceeds through hypotheses to more or less probable theories. It aims at theories that are universally valid, but still it's concerned with further determinations that bring about an ever closer approximation to the concrete, and reserves a notable role for statistical laws that speak of concrete events that are likely to occur. Fourth issue in the contemporary horizon, critical history, hermeneutics and history as Wissenschaft, human studies as opposed to human science, especially the method of critical history, which is not a matter of believing testimonies, but of intelligently investigating evidence. A fifth issue is method, which is expected to yield a cumulative series of different and better results, and which sets the mold for all modern sciences and academic disciplines. Empirical method, as developed in the natural sciences, can be expanded into a generalized empirical method that yields, the only typo in this whole paper, yields an ongoing genesis of methods to meet the exigencies of different fields of inquiry and calls for interdisciplinary studies that move many fields toward a unified view. So, again, a lot of these familiar themes in the last part. We can stop there. We don't have much time, but I can maybe take a question or two. I found the most illuminating thing to be that, again, the new language of the undifferentiated eros for what earlier he had spoken of as the tidal movement or the passionateness of being, and his identifying that with starting in the unconscious and then moving up through all the levels of consciousness. Okay? So next week we will do, let's make it clear, and this is a slight change from the schedule. We'll do a post-Hegelian philosophy of religion, which is in a third collection. And we'll do reality, myth, symbol, which is in this book. And we'll leave the last class to Mary Jo and Ravi on Pope John's intention and unity and plurality. Okay? All righty. Thank you.
Thank you.